First, we will hear from Dr. Yu Chen and Dr. Maria Arger. Dr. Chen is a professor at the New York University School of Medicine within the Department of Population Health and Department of Environmental Medicine. She's a chronic disease epidemiologist involved in multidisciplinary research that focuses on how host and environmental factors are related to chronic diseases, including cardiovascular disease and cancer. For nearly two decades, she has worked with colleagues from Columbia University and the University of Chicago to study health effects of arsenic exposure in Bangladesh as a part of the Health Effects of Arsenic Longitudinal Study, also known as HEALS. She received her PhD with distinction in epidemiology from Columbia University in 2005. And Dr. Argus is an associate professor of epidemiology at the University of Illinois at Chicago School of Public Health. Her research focuses on environmental and molecular epidemiology of chronic diseases, with particular emphasis on the health effects of metal exposure. She's the PI of the Bangladesh Environmental Research in Children's Health Cohort that aims to evaluate early life health effects of arsenic exposure in metal mixtures. She's also a co-investigator of the HEALS study. She holds an MPH in Environmental Health Sciences and a PhD in Epidemiology from Columbia University. Dr. Chen and Dr. Argos, I will now turn it over to you.
Thank you so much for the introduction. I would like to thank the NIEHS Superfund program for the opportunity to present. So I'll be talking about exposure and latent disease risk using arsenic as a case study. Inorganic arsenic is an element of the Earth's crust and can be released into groundwater. Elevated arsenic concentration in groundwater is a public health issue in the world, including in the U.S. In the U.S., in addition to water, inorganic arsenic has been detected in foods such as rice, rice cereal, and wine and juices. The long-term health effects of arsenic exposure include non-melanoma skin cancer, several internal cancers, neurological effects, cardiovascular disease, pulmonary disease, and adverse reproductive health outcomes. Evidence of the health outcome came from mostly studies of exposure and outcomes in adults. However, data are limited on health effects in other time periods. In year 2000, as part of the Columbia Superfund Research Program, we established the health effects of arsenic longitudinal study in Bangladesh with an initial 11,746 participants that later were expanded to 35,000 participants. Water samples from more than 12,000 wells were tested for arsenic, and the overall response rate was 96%. Blood and urine samples were collected from almost everyone, and in-person visits that include blood pressure measurement takes place every 2 years. So on the left, you can see the satellite map of arsenic concentration in the area. It's very colorful, showing a very large variation in the exposure. The key findings of the cohort include data on all-cause mortality and cardiovascular disease incidence and mortality. Cumulative mortality that's shown in the figure was higher in those with higher levels of arsenic at baseline, and we estimate that 23.5% of the deaths in the population can be attributable to arsenic exposure greater than 10 microgram per liter in the population. We also found a dose response association between arsenic exposure and cardiovascular disease mortality. Individuals in the highest quartiles of urinary arsenic were 1.5 times more likely to die from cardiovascular disease, and they were also 2 times more likely to die from heart disease compared with individuals with bottom quartile. There is a growing body of evidence that prenatal and early childhood exposure to arsenic can have serious long-term health implications. Animal studies support potential effects on cancer and atherosclerosis. There has been some ecological studies indicate that in utero or early life exposure to arsenic at high levels can have an effect on mortality from cancer, cardiovascular disease, and respiratory disease. However, there is a need for more epidemiology studies to examine the relationship to early indicators of disease and also at lower exposure levels. There are several times when individuals are more sensitive to any adverse effects of arsenic, such as during pregnancy, when women undergo physiological changes and hormone changes that can make them more susceptible, and also during childhood and adolescence, when cardiovascular function develops and matures, or during fetus and infancy in the first years of life, when they undergo very rapid development. However, epidemiology evidence are limited. So in HEOS adults, blood pressure was measured every 2 years in the original cohort. Using this longitudinal data with repeated measurements of blood pressure and also use mixed effects models over the first 8 years, we report that blood pressure increases more rapidly every year by about 0.4 mmHg per year in participants in the highest three quartiles of arsenic exposure compared with those in the bottom quartile. So the results were very similar using either water or urinary arsenic as an exposure variable, and also we found similar association for either systolic or diastolic blood pressure, but there was no dose-response relationship. We collaborated with Margaret Karagas and Sheree Farzan from the New Hampshire birth cohort study using data from more than 500 pregnant women and data on repeated blood pressure measurements during the course of pregnancy. Sheree ran the same mixed effects model that we ran in the HEOS adults, and she reported that each 5 microliter increase in urinary arsenic was associated with a 0.15 mmHg increase in systolic blood pressure every month. So these results confirm findings from previous cross-sectional studies on arsenic and blood pressure, and also indicate that pregnant women are susceptible to the effects. And high blood pressure during pregnancy is related to a greater risk of later life cardiovascular disease and related to adverse birth outcomes. In HEOS, the correlations between children's urinary arsenic and mother's urinary arsenic was the same as the correlation between the mother's own urinary arsenic and water arsenic. Both are 0.75, so the correlation. This corroborates that both mothers and children are largely consuming water from the same source, and therefore a mother's exposure over time can be an excellent proxy for her child's exposure over time. So in year 2012 to 2015, we recruited 725 adolescents who were offsprings of the HEOS female participants, and we measured their blood pressure, and we used maternal urinary arsenic that was available every 2 to 4 years their exposure when they were growing up. We also measure urinary arsenic for the adolescents at the recruitment. Early childhood exposure was defined as the maternal urinary arsenic measure when the adolescent was less than 5 years old. And later childhood exposure was defined as the average maternal urinary arsenic measure when the adolescents were 5 to 12 years old. So overall, we found effects of arsenic exposure measure at an adolescent. We found effects of arsenic exposure measured at adolescent, at the recruitment, as well as effects of early childhood exposure on systolic blood pressure, but we did not see effects on effects of later childhood, or we also didn't see effects on diastolic blood pressure. The association of adolescents' current arsenic exposure with the systolic blood pressure was evident, controlling for other exposure, including cadmium, manganese, lead, and selenium. So we also didn't identify any interaction between arsenic and other elements. We further stratified the data by adolescents, BMI, the effects of urinary arsenate in early childhood and also urinary arsenate during adolescence were more pronounced in adolescents with a higher BMI compared with those with a lower BMI. So these findings support that BMI may modify the cardiovascular disease effects of arsenic exposure, and that the association of arsenic exposure with systolic blood pressure is not confounded by malnutrition. We also used wear quartile sum regression to evaluate the overall effects of correlated exposure at different life stage on blood pressure. So arsenic exposure measured at different life stages were positively correlated with one another with a correlation from 0.46 to 0.7. So we used this method to see which stages of arsenic exposure is driving the association. The wear index was significantly associated with systolic blood pressure in the study samples, indicating a significant overall effect, and the association was mostly driven by adolescents' current urinary arsenate, which had the greatest weight of 53%, followed by maternal early childhood exposure, which has a 35% of the weight. So the data suggests that the effects of arsenic on blood pressure that found in adults can be observed as early as adolescence, during which the cardiovascular function develops and matures. And the data suggests that effects of early childhood exposure remain. And in the same adolescents, intellectual function was measured using modified versions of Wechsler intelligence scale for children. We observed significant negative association between urinary arsenic and all the scores in adolescents. Gail Wasserman and Joe Graziano have conducted a serious cross-sectional study in 6-year-old, 10-year-old, and 8 to 11-year-old children in our population, as well as grades 3 to 5 in men. So these data indicate the adverse consequences of arsenic exposure on neurological neurodevelopment observed in these cross-sectional studies of younger children are also apparent during adolescence. So I'm going to let Maria to continue.
Great, thanks you. So I'll also describe some additional work that we've done towards this end. Beginning in 2011, we began to prospectively document all pregnancies among female participants of the health effects of arsenic longitudinal study that you described. And these data enabled us to evaluate associations between arsenic exposure and pregnancy outcomes in the cohort. In a recent analysis, we assessed the association between maternal urinary total arsenic concentration with adverse pregnancy outcomes. And we observed an increased risk of adverse pregnancy outcomes overall and found that it was primarily stillbirths that drove this association. However, we do acknowledge that there was underreporting of early pregnancy losses and that there does appear to be a suggestive association of arsenic with spontaneous abortion, which may become more apparent with a more comprehensive capture of the early pregnancy losses in this population. We had the opportunity to also use data from the National Children's Study to look at the association between maternal arsenic exposure with birth outcomes in a population that has much lower levels of arsenic exposure. In that analysis, we evaluated the association between maternal third trimester urinary arsenic concentrations with characteristics of the infant at birth, including gestational age, birth weight, birth length, head circumference, and ponderal index. We saw evidence of a positive dose response association between urinary total arsenic concentration with birth length, as well as with dimethyl arsenic, which is a prevalent urinary metabolite of inorganic arsenic exposure. We also observed a positive dose response relationship between arsenic and head circumference, and an inverse dose-dependent association with ponderal index, which is a metric similar to body mass index.
We also evaluated these associations disaggregated by infant sex. In those analyses, we observed that the associations with birth length, head circumference, and ponderal index were mostly similar for male and female infants. However, when we looked at the association with gestational age, we saw that arsenic was associated with reduced gestational age, but the association was limited just to female infants. We're also interested in further investigating the health effects of arsenic exposure in populations with lower dose exposure concentrations, such as the population of the United States. And this is being done through a collaboration with the U.S. Geological Survey. In the conterminous United States, there are approximately 44 million people that drink water from unregulated private wells. And among this population, it's been estimated that about 2 million of these individuals in the U.S. are exposed to arsenic in their drinking water at concentrations higher than 10 micrograms per liter. As you can see from the map shown, which shows the probability of groundwater exceeding 10 micrograms per liter, there are several affected regions across the United States that we're interested in examining further. The funding that we obtained from the U.S. Geological Survey through the John Wesley Powell Center for Analysis and Synthesis, we formed a working group of U.S. Geological Survey scientists as well as public health researchers to evaluate the health effects of arsenic exposure in the United States. This working group has two primary goals. The first is to update the previously published arsenic map that I showed on the previous slide for the conterminous United States, which was recently completed, and the publication of this work is forthcoming. The second goal of this working group is to use the updated groundwater arsenic exposure estimates to look at associations with various outcomes, including the evaluation of birth outcomes on the national scale, using data that was made available at the individual level through the National Center for Health Statistics. This will enable us to look at more than 10 million births occurring in the United States between 2014 and 2016. And in these analyses, we're interested in specifically evaluating associations of arsenic with gestational age and birth weight. So we've also been interested in looking at the early life health effects of arsenic exposure in Bangladesh. And in 2014, we established the Bangladesh Environmental Research in Children's Health Study, which we refer to as the BIRCH cohort. The purpose of this cohort is to investigate the health effects of prenatal and early life arsenic exposure on various outcomes, including hormone levels, clinical characteristics with an initial focus on cardiometabolic trait trajectories, and DNA methylation. The cohort currently includes 500 mother-child pairs, which were recruited among female participants of our HEALS cohort. Enrolled children underwent a clinical evaluation, and we've conducted several laboratory assays as well as collected questionnaire data. We also collected extensive biological specimens, including blood, spot urine, toenail clippings, and naturally shed teeth from the children, as well as saliva samples from the children, as well as both biological parents. So here I'm showing some selected characteristics of the mothers and children that we've enrolled. Approximately 80% of the women in the study have some formal education, with about 50% reporting land ownership or television ownership, which are proxy measures of socioeconomic status in this population. More than 75% of the births were the results of natural delivery, and more than half of them were home births. Nearly half the women reported exposure to secondhand smoke, primarily from the spouse, during the pregnancy. Among the children, the average age was 6 years, with almost equally distributed children by sex. All children were reported to be breastfed as infants. While we did not have measures of birth weight due to the home births in this population, we did ascertain mothers' reported assessment of the child's birth size, with about 25% of the women reporting that the child was either small or very small compared to other infants. And nearly 25% of the women said that the child suffered from some sort of general illnesses, with about 15% having reported hospitalizations up to age 6 years. We measured the urinary total arsenic concentration, fasting plasma glucose, and blood lipids of the children at the time of enrollment. And in these initial cross-sectional analyses, we see that among children with the highest urinary total arsenic concentrations, there's a suggestive association with increased fasting plasma glucose concentrations as well as HDL cholesterol. We observed suggestive inverse relationships of urinary total arsenic concentration with LDL cholesterol as well as with triglyceride levels. In our subsequent analyses in Birch, we'll be evaluating genetic susceptibility to arsenic exposure among the children, since our prior work in the parent HEALS cohort has identified key genetic variants associated with arsenic metabolism and subsequent susceptibility to arsenic toxicity. This genotyping is currently underway, but as an overview of what we observed among the adults in the HEALS cohort, we identified several genetic variants near the arsenic methyltransferase gene, AS3MT, which are associated with arsenic metabolism based on our evaluation with urinary arsenic species. And as shown on the table in this slide, we identified two independent genetic variants that are associated with arsenic metabolism, but also with the presence of skin lesions, which is a hallmark characteristic of arsenic toxicity. And in a recent follow-up analysis, using newly generated data on an additional subset of HEALS participants, we were able to identify a novel genetic variant for arsenic metabolism located in the FTCD gene. As shown in the figure on this slide, this gene encodes an important enzyme that's involved in one carbon metabolism, which plays a key role in the metabolism of arsenic. As described by Rebecca Fry in the first session of the seminar series, aberrant DNA methylation is a consequence of arsenic exposure and a potential underlying mode of action for arsenic toxicity. She described some of the existing studies that evaluated prenatal arsenic exposure with cord blood DNA methylation. We had the opportunity to evaluate associations between blood and urinary arsenic concentrations with whole blood epigenome-wide DNA methylation in Bangladeshi adults. And in those analyses, we identified four differentially methylated loci. The biological functions of these genes have been primarily related to pathways associated with skin carcinogenesis and hypertension, which epidemiologic evidence has suggested is associated with chronic arsenic exposure. And we also recently generated additional DNA methylation data on 400 participants from the HEALS cohort, doubling the sample size of our original analysis, which enabled us to conduct a meta-analysis of the associations of arsenic with CpG methylation, the results of which were recently published. In those analyses, we observed 221 CpG sites associated with urinary total arsenic concentration. There was significant enrichment of genes annotated to reactive oxygen species pathways, inflammatory response, and tumor necrosis factor alpha and nuclear factor kappa B signaling. Additionally, several of our originally identified CpG sites were replicated, as well as methylation sites that have been identified by others as being associated with prenatal arsenic exposure. So while this work was conducted in adults, we are also currently generating DNA methylation data for the Birch cohort, and we'll be conducting analyses to evaluate associations in early life as well. So I'd like to conclude by acknowledging the support that we've received from the Superfund program, the NIEHS, and the NIH. And if there's time, we'd be happy to take any questions.
Great. Thank you, Drs. Chen and Argos. We do have a couple of questions that have come through, so I will start with the first one. Where is the arsenic coming from in the wine?
I think the arsenic coming from the wine is also from the soil that grows the grapes. So arsenic, Maria, do you have any thoughts?
Sure. So, I mean, there have been studies to show that several fruits and vegetables, as you mentioned, because of elevated soil or water exposures, are elevated in arsenic concentrations. So our assumption is that in the processing of the grapes, this results in the subsequent wine also being elevated in arsenic.
The next question that came in is, I noticed that your models did not include a metric for urine dilution, such as specific gravity. Can you please explain why this was missing?
In many of our analysis, we also use specific. We also account for this using different methods. The results are mostly similar, so we usually report the main findings based on urinary creatinine-adjusted arsenic.
All right, the next question is more of a statement and a question. So our population was exposed to arsenic not necessarily from well water, but from arsenic applied as a pesticide to agricultural crops, especially in citrus crops in Florida. I'm wondering if any studies have been done on or with this population, and if now, what we can extrapolate from this data that might be relevant to the population of low-income minority agricultural workers in the country.
Maria, you want to?
Sorry, there's the last part of the part. The arsenic in well water in your map does not reflect levels of arsenic to which agricultural laborers may have been exposed to more directly through application in farm fields, and thank you. Sorry, that was the rest of it.
I think. Okay. Yeah, that's an excellent point. So the map that I showed that's been produced by the U.S. Geological Survey is only estimates of arsenic exceedance of the regulatory threshold in groundwater sources. So if there are agricultural workers that are being exposed either through application or surface water sources, that is not accounted for in the map that was shown. With respect to studies that have been done looking at, so I guess it would either be inhalational exposure or maybe dermal exposure to arsenic through agricultural application of pesticides and other products. I'm not that familiar with literature that has looked at just those populations with respect to arsenic toxicity, and I don't know of any work that was done specifically for that population in Florida. You know, but again, that would be, I think, an important a question to look at as we consider environmental justice issues in the United States.
Yes. So we use urinary arsenic as a biomarker for arsenic exposure, which is an integrated measure for arsenic coming from all sources. So to some extent, you can if the arsenic is ingested, not inhaled, to some extent, this can be extrapolated to other populations. But we have to consider the differences in population and other risk distributions or other risk factors.
Okay. Next question that's come through is, what was the proportion of arsenicoline unrelated to inorganic arsenic exposure in total urinary arsenic?
In our Bangladesh population, the proportion of arsenic choline and B10 is pretty small. It was less than 5%, and there was no correlation between the seafood related arsenic and water arsenic, and no overall correlation between seafood related arsenic and total urinary arsenic. There was a pretty high correlation between total urinary arsenic and water arsenic. So in the Bangladesh population, most of the most of the arsenic is coming from the water? That's a very good question.
Next question is the arsenic found in the soil associated with lead most of the time?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
Sure. Is arsenic found in the soil associated with lead most of the time?
I don't know about this, but in our population, we measure arsenic in water, not in the soil. To my knowledge, I don't know. I don't think the arsenic in soil is related to the lead. Maria?
So within just soil measurements, I'm not sure, and there might be regional differences. But we, in general, don't see high correlations between arsenic and lead.
Okay. The next question is anyone, do you know if anybody is studying potential confounding effects with PFAS?
No, we didn't measure the in our population, but unless it's coming from the water, yeah, I don't know how they are correlated. And I don't know the levels of the PFAS in the population may be low. It's pretty rural population, but it's an interesting topic.
There's a lot of questions coming through. We're going to try to get as many as we can through during your Q&A time before we have to switch over to the next one. So the next one is, in Bangladesh, is the major source of arsenic from drinking water and the soil, or are there artificial sources?
Maria, you want to take this one?
Sure. So in terms of the rural population that we've been primarily working with, naturally occurring arsenic that leaches into the groundwater is the primary source of arsenic. Essentially, this is all natural arsenic exposure that's going into the groundwater.
All right. Let's see. There's lots of questions coming through. I'm trying to sort through them. okay, the next question is, did you see a relationship with arsenic and cadmium?
Cadmium, I think we saw very weak association, was not a strong association. In the blood pressure analysis, we control for cadmium, and the association was, the effects that we see between arsenic and blood pressure in the adolescent remain pretty the same.
Okay, and we're running out of time, so we will share these questions with the presenters and the information, and hopefully they will get back to the person who asked the question. And if we have time at the end, we will take more questions for both Dr. Chen and Argos. So thank you again, Dr. Chen and Argos, for a great presentation.
Thank you so much.
So next, we will hear from Dr. Fena Sillier, an assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. She is researching how early life exposures change the immune system and increase the risk of respiratory infections and lung cancer in later life. Her lab currently focuses on the effect of arsenic exposure on tuberculosis, influenza, and vaccine efficacy. Prior to joining Johns Hopkins, Dr. Sillier was a postdoc fellow at UC Berkeley. As an alumna of the UC Berkeley SRP Center, she collaborates with Dr. Craig Steinmoss and Dr. Martin Smith from UC Berkeley and Dr. Caterina Ferreccio from the Pontifica Universidad de Chile on studies assessing the long-term effects of a unique early-life arsenic exposure situation in northern Chile. Dr. Sillier, I'll now turn it over to you.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for the invitation to speak today. And I'll be presenting the latest findings on the long-term impact of perinatal arsenic on the immune system and disease risk. All studies have been performed in accordance with the IRB and ACOG of the institutions involved, and I have no conflict of interest to declare. So first, I would like to briefly highlight the importance of the immune system. Our health status is about to balance, is all about the balance in immunity. During normal homeostasis, there is a balance at the overall net effect of immunity. Immunomodulation, for example, by drugs, pharmaceuticals, or pollutants, so as we can see here, can disrupt this homeostasis. You can either have that the balance is skewed towards immunosuppression, what you see here, and this could subsequently lead to an enhanced susceptibility to cancers, infectious diseases, and other chronic diseases. On the other hand, the homeostasis could be skewed towards immunoenhancement, which can lead to autoimmune disease, hypersensitivity, allergy, inflammatory diseases, and tissue damage. The susceptibility to disease also depends on genetic background and interaction with other endogenous and environmental factors. At the population level, this can be observed either as an individual with each a different type of response, or many individuals with multiple disorders simultaneously or consecutively. So I would also like to mention a few highlights about the different vulnerable windows of susceptibility during immune development specifically. So how can an environmental exposure that occurs early in life a cause and effect later in life? There we go. So from an immunologist perspective, we would like to think about permanent alterations in the development and an epigenetic programming of the immune system. The development of different immune cell types, it already starts around gestational week 7, and immune development continues throughout the childhood, and it's only complete at around age 18. Certain immune processes, such as the development of memory cells, keep developing throughout life. Because in my lab, we are interested in why early life exposure to arsenic causes lung cancer and respiratory infection, you'll see later in this talk that we focus our research on macrophages, and those are over here, which are important innate immune cells in the lung. Developmental immunotoxicity and the windows of susceptibility, as you can see here in this review from Jamie DeWitt et al., is surrounds several windows of susceptibility that are gestation, during lactation, pre-pubescent, and post-puberty. Again, many of these main developmental processes, such as hematopoiesis, migration of stem cells and expansion of progenitor cells, as well as the colonization of bone marrow thymus, occurs during gestation. And other events, such as maturation of the immune competence and establishment of immune memory, occur later in life as well. Important what this review highlights is that there are differences between rodent and human systems, but there's also a lot of overlap, which makes the rodent system still a valuable model to analyze what happens in humans in early life exposure. So next, I would like to focus on the in utero and early life exposures to arsenic and later life disease in a human population. So as you already heard in the previous talk, arsenic is a ubiquitous pollutant with many adverse health effects. I just wanted to highlight here that arsenic is also a powerful immunotoxicant, associated with several immune-related diseases such as type 2 diabetes, respiratory infections, inflammatory lung diseases such as COPD and bronchiectasis, as well as many cancers. Through my collaborations with the groups of Professors Martin Smith, Alan Smith, and Dr. Franz Steinmaus at UC Berkeley, and Dr. Caterina Ferriccio at the Pontificia Universidad Católica de Chile, I have collaborated on research on samples from a unique arsenic-exposed population in the northern Chilean city of Antofagasta. Antofagasta is a desert city, heavily relying on a singular level river for their only water source in the 50s. As the city grew in 1958, water was sourced from additional rivers coming from the Sierras behind the city. Unfortunately, these rivers happened to be heavily contaminated with arsenic, about 800 micrograms per liter, which is almost 80 times higher than the drinking water standard set by the United States Environmental Protection Agency. After 12 years of arsenic exposure, an arsenic removal plant was finally installed in 1971. This unique arsenic exposure scenario provides a rare opportunity to investigate the long-term impact of early life arsenic exposure. And there are indeed many long-term effects of this early life exposure. As you can see here, this is the window of high exposure. And you can see that anyone who was born from in the windows 1958 to 1970 or born before the 1958 arsenic exposure has an increased standard mortality rate for various diseases, including bronchiectasis, COPD, lung cancer, also other cancers such as bladder cancer. And the biggest increases are for lung cancer, which is sevenfold, an 18-fold increase in both bladder cancer and bronchiectasis. But other mortality, such as from diseases such as acute myocardial infarction and pulmonary tuberculosis, were also increased compared to the non-exposed population in, for example, Santiago, which is in Region 5. So Antofagasta is in Region 2. The interesting part here is that the highest standard mortality rates are coming from people that were born exactly during the window of exposure, which is in the Black year, Black War. And this is data from 4 years later. So there's an enormous delay in mortality rates that are occurring from diseases that occurred upon an exposure that occurred 40 years past. So this population provides us unique evidence supporting the developmental origin of health and disease hypothesis. Given that maternal exposures from example, pollutants, pharmaceuticals, as well as dietary and microbes, biometabolites, they can be communicated to the virus transmissibly and to the infant via lactation. The DOHA, as it is called, paradigm, holds that such early life exposures cause developmental changes leading to later life disease. Many analyses have been performed on data from this Chilean study population. Here, for example, you can see that lung cancer, here's my pointer, that lung cancer odds ratios comparing subjects exposed to more than 800 micrograms per liter to subjects exposed to less than 110 micrograms per liter by age of exposure. And what is clear from the figure on the left is that the odds ratios are highest among the those who were still children during the time of arsenic exposure. So this is the age. What is evident from the figure on the right is that men and women have different odds ratios and that mortality rates are different among the sexes. But the overall similarity is that lung cancer mortality is greatly elevated in both men and women, even in the years 2000 and 2010, so which is almost, it's more than 40 years post-exposure scenario. This is also evident in when we look at bladder cancer. And as you can see here in the figure on the left, bladder cancer mortality for bladder cancer mortality were particularly high when people were exposed during early childhood to these high levels of arsenic in their drinking water. And again, here the difference between men and women is slight, but both in men and women, bladder cancer remains the mortality rates remain high even past 2010. So more than 40 years later. So there's a clear delay exposure and effect from early life arsenic exposure. In this slide, the UC Berkeley Superfund group has also shown that early life arsenic exposure combined with high VMAA later in life causes increased cancer risk. And you can see here that if the high VMAA is reported at age 40 and on, there's an increase in the odds ratio with increasing arsenic concentration levels, and but that this is the strongest if the high VMAA is reported at age 20. So the exposure to arsenic occurred early in life, and then at age 20 and up, when a high VMAA increased the cancer risk even further. Another immune-related disease is type 2 diabetes, which is characterized by a progressive status of chronic low-grade inflammation, and which is thought to be attributable to the autoimmune phenomenon. Shown here are the odds ratios that for diabetes for high arsenic exposure, and it's for each 10,000 micrograms per liter of years increase in cumulative exposure this time with a lag of 40 years by increasing levels of BMI. And as you can see here, increasing BMI increases the risk of type 2 diabetes from arsenic exposure even further. Interestingly, these risks of arsenic-related diabetes were found to be higher in the Chilean population when people had low socioeconomic status. And that's what this paper is about. What I found very interesting from an immunologist perspective and an infectious disease researcher is that mortality rates from infections such as tuberculosis are increased later in life. So as you can see here, when the exposure scenario ended in 1971, years later, and this is still continuing, there's newer data that this is still high, we have about a twofold increase in mortality rates from tuberculosis. And the interesting part is that it's not that the tuberculosis was reported at the time of exposure. So this is something that was contracted later in life, but the immune system is what we hypothesized was compromised and therefore is causing this higher mortality of an infectious respiratory disease that is contracted later in life. And here the data is compartmentalized by the exposure before the exposure scenario, those who were exposed before, during, and after the odds ratios when they were exposed to arsenic. So what we also looked at, and this is where my group was involved with, is that a chronic progressive status of chronic low-grade inflammation can contribute to type 2 diabetes, but it also can contribute to cancer risk. So we were wondering if low-grade inflammation was the case in this study population. And indeed, when we measured plasma cytokines and chemokine levels in healthy individuals, reportedly healthy, who are exposed to arsenic in their early life, we found that for the majority of cytokines, there was no significant association with the mean annual arsenic in drinking water at birth. However, we did find significant positive associations for pro-inflammatory cytokines such as IL-8, MIP-1 alpha, TNF-beta, and GCSF, suggesting that indeed a low-grade inflammatory status might be occurring in the study population, and that might be contributing to disease risk such as the type 2 diabetes and cancer. So to model further how in utero arsenic exposure occurs and affects disease risk, my lab is involved in utero arsenic exposure models in rodents as well as in vitro models. As you can see here, my postdoc, Crystal Ricklick, has developed an in utero arsenic exposure model where she focused on arsenic exposure particularly from gestational day 9 or 10 until birth. And we chose this exposure window because that evades the stem cell grafting and colonization, meaning that we only focus on the effects of arsenic on specifically immune cells that have been that are either developing or have been developed in the fetus. So in what we first did in this mouse model, where we exposed C57 lactic mice to sodium meta-arsenic in their drinking and the mother's in the drinking water of the dam, and then we let these mice get born, and we let them grow up without arsenic in their water until they are about 8 to 10 weeks old. And what we did then is we looked at lung function. And this is the window of 9 to 10 days gestational days till birth covers the early development of the lung of the lung. And what we tested in these mice that were adults, so later in life, affects is airway resistance to metacholine dose. And as you can see here, with increasing dose of metacholine, we you expect increasing airway resistance. And as you can see here, between the for males, between arsenic-exposed males and non-exposed males, which is the dark blue versus the light blue, we see a significant effect in airway resistance, with the resistance being higher in arsenic-exposed males. This effect, unfortunately, is lost with increasing doses of metacholine, so the sensitivity when we over exert these airways is lost. However, the difference between males and females is still significant between males and females, regardless of their arsenic status. When we look at this exposure window, so gestational day 10 to birth, from a heart perspective, together with our collaborator, Mark Kaur, we looked at the impact of this window on heart injury. The Kaur lab has shown before that there are sex-specific effects in adult mice who were exposed to arsenic. And but when we looked at the rate pressure product and the recovery of that, we did not see any difference between males or males with arsenic or females or any females exposed to in utero arsenic levels. There was a slight trend in infarct size for the females exposed to arsenic being having a little higher infarct size, but again, this was not significant. Next, we also looked at the chronic, the systemic serum cytokine levels as a proxy of the low-grade inflammation. And we assessed about 30 different cytokines and chemokines by Luminex assay. And we did not see the same pattern as we saw for the humans that were exposed to in utero arsenic in the Chilean population. We actually saw a little bit of a reduction and decrease only in the CXCL5, which is a cytokine that is involved with recruiting neutrophils in once the immune system is activated. So this is not consistent. However, as we know, this is, again, a very small window of exposure where we only go from gestational days 9 and 10 to birth, so targeting specifically immune cells and only partly developmental functions in other organs. When we extract alveolar or lung interstitial macrophages from these mice that were in utero exposed to arsenic from gestational day 10 to birth, we then activated these mice with LPS interferon gamma, which is an M1 stimulus, is what we call it in the field. And this M1 stimulation, which activates these macrophages, we can then measure cytokines. And one of the key cytokines that is expressed by these macrophages is interferon gamma itself. So the interferon gamma that we add in is serving as a sort of autocrine activation stimulus. And when we see, when we look at M1 stimulated macrophages from females, where we look at the blue bars are alveolar macrophages in non-exposed or arsenic, in utero arsenic exposed females. There is an upward trend, but it's not significant, neither is it for interstitial macrophages. However, for males that are born to mothers that were exposed to arsenic during gestation, they tend to birth, we actually see a significant decrease in the cytokines being produced by these macrophages once they're activated. So that means that these macrophages from these males that have been in utero exposed to arsenic are not as responsive when they are activated, for example, by LPS, which is a lipopolysaccharide, which is found in gram-positive bacteria. To study the effects of arsenic in more detail, we also look at it in an in vitro model where we have more macrophages that we can study if we derive them from bone marrow. So the hypothesis of focusing on macrophages is that macrophages are innate immune cells that are playing an important role in the innate immune system against both microbial infections as well as against tumors. So if macrophages are activated by M1 stimuli, they are pro-inflammatory, they have bactericidal activity, and they suppress tumors. And then on the other hand, macrophages, when they're activated by an M2 stimulus, are promoting scavenging, tissue repair, angiogenesis, and all these things are also helpful during a tumor, so they can be tumor promoting. And it's all about this homeostatic balance that I mentioned in the beginning, and we wanted to see what arsenic does to this balance between M1 and M2. So we focused on cytokines, nitric oxide production, and signaling lipids. Emily Illingworth, a PhD student in my lab, has developed an in vitro model for these macrophages that she derives from unexposed adult C57 LEX6 mice. And then in the presence of MCSF, she differentiates these to bone marrow-derived macrophages. And then she stimulates these with either, she treats these with several doses of inorganic arsenic or MMA, which is a more toxic metabolite of arsenic. And then she either stimulates them with LPS interferon gamma or with IL-4 and IL-13 for M2. And then we look at the cytokines, et cetera, and the nitric oxide and the lipids. So what she found when we looked at nitric oxide at, production, which we observed through a GREAT assay, is that when we treat these macrophages during their differentiation from bone marrow towards mature macrophages, so the arsenic is present during that differentiation, we see different effects in nitric oxide and the effect of arsenic on that production than if we would expose these macrophages after they are already mature. Interestingly also, what we found is that there is a significant difference in male and females, both during differentiation and when arsenic is present after the maturation only. We also looked at this in cytokine production, and as you can see here, we measured that by Luminex assay, and these macrophages were either, this time we picked a standard dose of 0.1 micromolars of inorganic arsenic, and then we looked at M1 stimulus by LPS interferon gamma, and M2 stimulus, so the more tumor-promoting stimulus of IL-4 and IL-13. And here again, when we only looked at females in this case, we looked at more than 50 different cytokines and chemokines. There's only a few that were significantly suppressed in the M0 state, so the homeostatic state, so neutral macrophages. But when we activate these macrophages with an M1 stimulus, there was actually an interesting increase of CXCL1. However, for males, we see a very different pattern. There was no difference in the homeostatic state for males, so the M0 state, but in males, there was a significant decrease in several chemokines in the M1 stimulated macrophages, and only one for the M2 stimulus. So that's a very different pattern in males and females, and also depending on what status the macrophages are in and what state of activation, we see different effects of arsenic, basically. When we looked at arsenic in signaling lipids, and unfortunately we only still have data from females in this case, we did an untargeted analysis by mass spec for lipidomics, and we found 53 different signaling lipids that were differently expressed in macrophages that were exposed to 1 micromolar of MMA3. We are still in the process of identifying what these lipids are and what their role is in immune signaling. And therefore, what we did also is a targeted approach where we look at signaling lipids that we know upfront what they are. And then in these female bone marrow derived macrophages, we actually see a very increase of lipids, and many of these lipids have a pro-inflammatory and pro-tumorigenic role that they play in both humans as well as in rodents. So this is very interesting, because what we think is what's happening is that the M1 pro-inflammatory and bactericidal activity of these macrophages is suppressed. So the M1 function is suppressed, while the M2 function, which can be tumor promoting, and that's heavily based on the signaling pro-tumorigenic and pro-inflammatory lipids, is what may cause tumor promotion. And that's how arsenic affects these macrophages specifically. So we have a lot of preliminary data that we want to validate, but also we want to bring further and see if these macrophages indeed play a role in disease settings. So we are testing this both in vitro as well as in vivo in disease models, infectious disease models, including influenza and TB, and for enduring cancer promotion to see if these macrophages play a role there. So in conclusion, what I've shown is that with the collaborators in Chile, that in the human population, in utero as well as early life, arsenic exposure leads to an increased inflammatory cytokine profile more than 40 years after exposure has ceased. And that is also that we see increased mortality from many immune-related diseases more than 40 years later. I've shown that in mice, however, we see very little of the pro-inflammatory cytokines, and if anything, the TFCL5 was reduced. We did not see any major effect on ischemia or on airway resistance. Only with males, we saw a little bit of airway resistance at low methicillin dose challenge. But the most important findings are in macrophages, when we look at macrophages specifically. And we find that the biggest effect of arsenic is during differentiation. And what we observe, and this has been supported by sporadic evidence in the literature as well, is that these macrophages under arsenic exposure are being skewed from an M1 to an M2 phenotype. And that's how we see this, by reduced pro-inflammatory cytokines and increased pro-inflammatory lipids, and that there is a major female and male difference in these, in any of these effects. So with that, I would like to thank you. I would like to thank all the members from Atelier Lab, my collaborators at Doug Hopkins, as well as UC Berkeley and in Chile, and for the funding. And if there's any time for questions, I would be happy to take them.
Thank you, Dr. Celia. That was a great presentation. So we do have a couple of questions that have come through the Q&A pod, but also I just wanted to remind everybody that you can submit your questions in the Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. So to start off, the first question that came in was, were the rivers contaminated with arsenic because of any upstream mining or drilling types of activities?
So the idea is that it's probably a natural occurring event, because the sierras are high in arsenic content in the groundwater. So these rivers are probably naturally high contaminated, but there is mining also occurring in the sierra, so it could be also that some of the mining activities indeed add to the levels of arsenic in the rivers. But originally, this is an area that is known to be high with arsenic concentrations in the ground and groundwater, yes.
Okay, thank you. Next question is, why was there higher lung cancer from water exposure? Is the water exposure a surrogate for air exposure? And like areas with high water levels had high air levels.
So I know of anecdotal studies that have been done in Antofagasta that they measured air exposure to arsenic, mainly from dust that would be entering the houses. However, that type of exposure is minimal, and it's more of a concern now that the water treatment plant is installed. So the drinking water exposure, which was extremely high, more than around 800 micrograms per liter, that was the dominant form of arsenic exposure. The levels in dust is minimal, so it's very interesting indeed that the lung is one of the major organs being targeted by gestational intake of arsenic. And this is not the only study where we see this. This is also seen in Bangladesh. So the lung is sensitive even if arsenic is being ingested through either drinking water or through food intake. So it's metabolized in the body, and it's known to be circulating through blood and enters different other organs. So what is thought to be the case is that because the lung is such an organ with a good blood interface, is that that's why there's higher exposure or sensitive exposure levels in the lung. And that's why the lung is one of the increased organs at risk, even though the gestation occurs through drinking water.
Thank you. The next question is, have you looked at potential effects of the perinatal exposure in this cohort on the efficacy of, the efficiency of vaccination?
So we've not looked at vaccination yet. It's interesting because I am involved with a researcher here at Johns Hopkins, Chris Heaney, who has a study where, also in Bangladesh, but it's not a real study, where they are looking for the effect of arsenic during pregnancy on both protection against the influenza vaccine to the mom, but also the effect, the protective effect that the fetus and the newborn normally has, and to see if arsenic indeed also disrupts that vaccine efficacy. We have in my lab a study that is paralleling that in adult mice that have been vaccinated, and we also did in utero exposed mice to arsenic, and I didn't have time in this talk to indicate those findings, but with in utero, we're setting very tight windows of exposure again, similar as what we did with the in vivo arsenic exposure that I showed before, and with the very tight exposures, we don't see in utero effects on influenza vaccine efficacy, and that is a mouse model of the influenza vaccine, so it might be that also the model is restrictive. But when we do expose adult mice to arsenic and then we look at a vaccine response, the influenza vaccine response, we definitely see that the immune system is changed, and opposite to what we thought we would see in a suppression, we actually see that indeed we do see the suppression. So the primary infection, we see an increase, so a more pro-inflammatory immune response, but we see a suppressive effect of arsenic on immune-related cells that are important to the vaccine. We don't, in this model, break the vaccine protection, so they still eventually recover. But when we look at the immune response, we definitely see a suppression of the arsenic on the vaccine response.
Interesting.
But we have not done that in the human population. Sorry. Yeah.
All right. Okay. So next question that came in was, what doses of arsenic were used in the ex vivo bone marrow-derived macrophage cultures?
Sorry, again, can you repeat the question?
What doses of arsenic were used in the ex vivo bone marrow-derived macrophage culture?
Oh, so for those, we used a range. We initially did a range of 0.0001 micromolar is up to 1, and we made sure that with cell viability, we made sure that the cells were still viable so that we are not looking at the effects of cell death or apoptosis. And eventually we settled on a dose of 0.01 for future purposes, because doing all the big experiments on a whole range of doses was too much. But we see basically a non-monotonic dose response for some of the, for especially for females.
Okay. So we've lots of other questions coming in.
Yeah, no worries.
The audience is very quizzical today. So the next, you answered partially of this one where you said that the lungs are a target, but this person asked which organs in the human are also targets of arsenic.
Well, I almost, and I bet the other speakers will agree, there's almost the question, I would almost reverse the question and ask which organ is not affected by arsenic exposure in the human body, because we see cognitive effects, we see liver cancer, we see kidney and bladder cancers, we see lung effects, various, not just lung cancer, but also the bronchiectasis, et cetera. There have been reports on reproduction, so the testes and ovaries are affected. There's so many organs that are affected by arsenic that I think it's almost, you should almost flip the question and ask which one is not. And I actually won't know which one. I, to be honest, I don't know which organ is not affected. Sorry.
All right. So we have time for one more question. And this last one is, have you considered that there may be differences in tissue-resident macrophages versus macrophages that are recruited to areas of inflammation as monocytes?
Yes, we definitely have considered that. And that's why also we initially started with the in vivo model to look at macrophages. But the limitation there is that macrophages, for example, in the lung are very, very few. So a lot of the experiments we were not able to do with various doses or easily do the assays. So that's why we were looking for an in vitro model. And the bone marrow-derived macrophage model is a very established immune model in the immunology field. And what they mimic basically is circulating macrophages. So circulating macrophages come from monocytes and then populate the tissues when there is an infection or when there's need for macrophage activity, or for example, in the tumor, monocyte-derived macrophages that come in and act upon the tumor either in an M1 or M2 fashion. So there's definitely differences, and we're trying to address those. But I think with arsenic exposure, both of them are affected, because the monocytes that are already there and will need to differentiate are also exposed to arsenic. So we're targeting, like, the arsenic exposure targets all types of macrophages in the human body.
Great. All right. Thank you. Thank you again, Dr. Cillier, for a great presentation. If we have time at the end, we'll ask these additional questions that have come through the chat pod. But if we don't have time, we will be sure to send them to you.
Okay.
Okay. And then, so last but not least, we will hear from Dr. Eric Tokar, who leads the Stem Cell Toxicology Group in the National Toxicology Program Laboratory branch of the National Toxicology Program at NIEHS. He received his PhD in cancer biology from the Michigan State University and did his postdoc fellowship at the National Cancer Institute. His research is focused on stem cells and cancer stem cells in inorganic carcinogenesis, and more recently on pluripotent stem cells in developmental toxicology. He's authored or co-authored over 70 publications, serves as the associate editor for Environmental Perspectives and several other scientific journals, and has served on multiple NTP, US EPA, and WHO review and science advisory panels. He's an active member of the Society of Toxicology and the North Carolina SOT Regional Chapter and the International Society for Stem Cell Research and the American Association of Cancer Research. Dr. Tokar, I will now turn it over to you.
Great, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody, or evening or morning, wherever you are out there in cyber land. I want to start by thanking everyone at the Superfund program for organizing these sessions as well as for the invitation. And today I'll be talking, as you can see from my title, the Association of Early Life Exposure to Arsenic and Cancer in Adulthood. So here's a real quick outline. I won't really go into background on arsenic. You've heard it all by now today. But there'll be some background on stem cells and cancer stem cells just so you know why we're looking at those and why they're important. Dr. Soulier mentioned a lot of it, but I'll go into a little bit more as far as the cancer aspects. And then I'll discuss our in vivo and in vitro work and end with a few slides on some more recent work we've done on effects of arsenic on the microenvironment and during carcinogenesis. So here's my obligatory world map of arsenic exposure slide. You've seen similar iterations of this in the previous talk, so I won't go into any detail on this. So I'll just sort of skip ahead and get to, as far as our studies, arsenic was always a bit of a paradox for us, paradoxical toxicant. It's, as you've heard, it's been a known human carcinogen for over 100 years. But it's also a relatively effective chemotherapeutic for certain types of leukemias, particularly acute promyelocytic leukemia. And in several of those studies, the authors suggested that this was the sort of the mode of action of arsenic was due to a targeting or a resetting of the leukemic stem cells. And the other sort of paradoxical thing was that there was always strong human data. Like I said, since the 1880s, it's been a human known human carcinogen. But there was very limited rodent data, and this is almost opposite of what you usually see with chemical carcinogenesis. And when we looked at those, there were several animal studies, and they pretty much all had negative results. And when we started really looking at those studies, we saw that all the animals were treated as adults. So with that in mind, and what we know about arsenic, it brought us to the hypothesis that perhaps arsenic is targeting stem cells, has some sort of affinity for stem cells or stem-like cells, and that it can alter the stem cell phenotype. And also, perhaps to be carcinogenic, at least in rodents, it may require an exposure of during a window of high sensitivity. And we thought perhaps in the perinatal or early life in utero exposure, because these would be periods where there's abundant stem cell numbers and abundant stem cell activity. So to study this, and I really need to give the credit to Mike Walkies on this. You see him pictured there. He really started these transfacental models several years before I even started with his group at NCI at NIEHS. I get to give the talks now, I guess, about it since Mike retired a few years ago, but he really deserves all the credit for these, what I consider some pioneering studies, at least in the arsenic carcinogenesis. But so you see his typical transfacental protocol here. Arsenic was given in the maternal drinking water only from gestation day 8 to 18. There were some studies where we also had added a promoter in some cases just to get a specific human target relevant cancer in the rodent models. Was done in several strains, you see listed there, partly just to show that it wasn't necessarily a strain-specific effect, but also if we were trying to target a specific type of cancer. And we, across all of the studies he did, which were several, he got very consistent results of tumors or neoplasia in both female and male offspring. And amongst the different sexes, he also got very consistent results as far as target tissues. A female, most cases seem to get lung, liver, urinary bladder, adrenal cancers. Male, liver, adrenal, lung, urinary bladder cancers. So he did several of these. You can see, I think this is all of them. I may be missing one or two, but just to give you an idea of how many times this was done, and I won't go into details on all of these, it just take too much time, but if you look at these papers, you'll see the very consistent results across all of them. And just to give you one example, this is the 03 paper, I think this is the first one to come out. You can see in the female data on the left, this is for lung carcinoma in the females, see a very strong trend for those lung tumors. And similarly in the male with their hepatocellular carcinoma, you see a dose-dependent trend, very strong increase in those hepatocellular carcinoma. And you can see in the text on the side all of the other tumors that these mice also got as they reached adulthood. And again, very similar results across the other strains when he did a similar transplacental exposures. So not to dismiss all the years and all the studies that Mike did, but to just save time, just a quick summary of all those transplacental studies. Again, just 10 days of exposure in utero, gestation day 8 to 18, in some cases with various promoters like estrogens or TPA or different metabolite of arsenic. We were able to get almost perfect concordance with all the human target sites of arsenic. We got bladder, skin, lung, liver, and kidney tumors. The only one we didn't get was prostate. We're not really sure why. Perhaps a species-specific issue, we're not really sure. But the other thing that was interesting to us was that we got this tumor formation long after the arsenic exposure ended. So it ended on gestation day 18. And then a year and a half, 2 years later, we're starting to get all of these tumors, which to us pointed to a very long-lived target cell. And that got us thinking about possibly targeting the stem cell. And oftentimes we get questions or critiques about the transplacental, and they say, well, that's not really human relevant. Humans are exposed throughout their entire life. And what you've heard from the previous two talks today is that's not always the case. You heard about the Bangladesh populations, the populations in Chile. If you were part of the first session, you heard Rebecca Fry talk about her work in her cohort in Mexico. There's also another good example shown here in the Okayama Prefecture in Japan in 1955. Infants were exposed. They drank this arsenic-contaminated baby formula, and 50, 60 years later, those who were exposed are developing all kinds of cancers in adulthood now. And this is in, compared to their non-exposed siblings. So very similar results, sort of like this early life pulse exposure with very similar results to the other human populations that you've heard about today. And as I said, we get some legitimate critiques or issues brought up with the transplacental model. As I said, people say, well, humans are exposed throughout their whole life. You're just treating the fetal stage. It's not environmental. So to address those issues, we move to what we call the whole life model, and you see the typical protocol here. The parents were given arsenic again in their drinking water approximately 2 weeks before breeding, and then it was kept in the mother's drinking water during pregnancy, weaning, and then the offspring had the same concentrations in their drinking water for up to 2 years. And I should also mention that the doses in these whole life studies were greatly reduced to, in some cases, that approached human exposure levels. And what we saw when we compared the results from the fetal only or the in utero, the transplacental exposure compared to the whole life, we consistently saw similar target sites. The target sites seemed to be the same. There were some differences, of course, but for the most part, they were the same. However, you can see from the graph on the left that we saw a greatly increased response in many of these target tissues in the whole life mice compared to the fetal-only mice. And not only did we see an increased response, the tumors in the whole life mice were also much more aggressive. So to us, this suggested there was transplacental exposure sort of dictated target site, and the rest of the exposure throughout the whole life was promoted this exposure. So as I said, early life exposure and then later life disease, to us that just sort of screamed it must be a stem cell that's getting targeted by arsenic here. And if you talk about stem cells and cancer, you undoubtedly will hear about the cancer stem cell hypothesis. And this is just saying, since stem cells and cancer stem cells share so many so many fundamental characteristics like self-renewal and ability to differentiate and so on, it must be an altered stem cell that's driving the tumorigenic process. There's also a couple sort of secondary questions to this hypothesis, at least that we're interested in trying to answer in our studies. And what is the cell of origin? Is it a altered stem cell, or is it a progenitor or adult stem cell? Is it a differentiated cell that, through some sort of oncogenic event, is now a dedifferentiated or reacquired stem-like characteristics? And the other question was, what about number of cancer stem cells per tumor? And this is likely carcinogen or tissue-dependent. So when we started looking at this, we went back to the tumors from our in vivo models. And you can see a transplacental example here on the left. This is one where we had a promoter. This is topical TPA to get skin tumors in the TGAC mice. And you can see comparing the, the TPA alone tumor here on the right, you see a few spots looks like good positive staining. I hope it's coming through on your screens. But comparing the TPA alone tumors to the arsenic plus TPA tumors, you really don't see the staining in the TPA alone that you do as far as how widespread and how intense the staining is in the arsenic plus TPA tumors. And these are stained for CD34, which is a very common marker for skin stem cells or skin cancer stem cells. And similarly, in our whole life model, tumors from those, you see control tumors for liver adenocarcinoma from control mice, spontaneous tumors from control mice here, and then the lung adenocarcinomas. And again, you might be able to see a few spots for some positive staining in those control tumors. But when you compare those to the staining, and this is ALDH1A, another common cancer stem cell characteristic marker, you don't see staining in the controls anywhere near like you do in the arsenic-induced tumors. And I don't show it here, but we did similar tests in tumors induced by other carcinogens, such as ENU, ethylnitrosourea. And the staining for those looked a little bit more abundant than in the controls, but again, it nothing like you saw in the arsenic. So it does appear that something with the arsenic is leading to this cancer stem cell overabundance compared to control tumors and tumors induced by other well-known carcinogens. So this brought us to our in vitro hypotheses, where we tried to answer mechanistic or, dare I say, adverse outcome pathway questions. And we thought that arsenic, maybe it's directly attacking the stem cells. This leads to the formation and overabundance of cancer stem cells, but possibly during the transformation, maybe it's also increasing the stem cell number, which would in turn increase the target cell population during transformation. And we've done this in a handful, probably maybe half dozen or so, 6, 7, or 8 different human cell lines, all human target relevant cell lines for arsenic carcinogenesis. You see them listed at the bottom, but the one I'll talk about today is the one with the RWPE1 cell line. And in every case, we start with the parental cell line, which is just a normal, non-tumorigenic human cell line. We directly transform that with chronic exposure over several weeks directly to arsenic to get, in this case, the KSPE cells, the arsenic transformed cells. And then also from the parental cell line, we isolate the adult stem cells or progenitor cells and then directly transform those cells using the exact same conditions we transform the parental line. We transform the stem cells into, in this case, arsenic cancer stem cells. and then we can do all these comparisons between all these different isogenic cell lines. So what we saw, and again, very consistent across all of the half dozen or so cell models we've done this in, is looking at just general apoptosis resistant factors. You see in the Western blots on the left that all of these factors favor a resistance, an apoptotic resistance in the stem cells, which is what you would expect. Stem cells are typically more resistant than their, more resistant to chemical insult than their differentiated counterparts. But looking at more arsenic-specific resistance factors, you see here in the middle, looking at GSC-pi, ABCC1, glutathione, ABCC2, which aren't shown, those all also favor resistance in the stem cells. And then our group and several others that look at arsenic chronic exposure have shown that the cells adapt to arsenic during chronic exposure. So we wanted to see if there was a difference there too. And you look at the innate LC50s here on the left, the parental line is in the gray, stem cells in the orange. You see the stem cells have, I think it was about a 30 micromolar LC50 compared to, I think it was 18 micromolar in the parental line. But after 6 weeks of chronic exposure, you can see, while both cells did adapt, you see the parental line did adapt. It went up to about 32 micromolar, I think. But again, nothing like the adaptability that you see in the stem cell. This went from about 30 up to a little over 100 micromolar. So that's what we call hyperadaptability in the stem cells. So with those, we showed that there appeared to be a survival selection with the stem cells to arsenic, but we still needed to show, can they be directly transformed by arsenic into a cancer stem cell? So we did our chronic exposure models, exposed to an environmentally relevant concentration for several weeks, during which time periodically assessed several markers of several in vitro metrics for transformation, and when enough of those suggested they were transformed, in a lot of cases, we did xenograft studies to confirm malignant transformation. And what we saw, again, very consistently across all the models, that the stem cells were rapidly transformed. In almost every case, I think in every case, they were transformed in several weeks sooner than the parental cell line was transformed. In this case, you see, again, the RWPE1 model I showed earlier. These are the stem cells. In about 18 weeks, you see about a 4.5-fold increase in MMP9 activity, common characteristic of cancer cells, increased MMPs. You also saw increases in ankyrogen-dependent growth, invasion, all kinds of genetic factors increased to suggest transformation. This highly dysregulated growth from single cells in Matrigel, see the control, you get these 3D sort of branching, almost ductile-like structures, and it's highly dysregulated in the arsenic-transformed cells. So again, once we get enough of those in vitro metrics suggesting transformation, then we move to the xenograft, and you see one example here. We did this tail vein, renal capsule, and sub-Q, and got pretty much the same results in all three types of injections. The injected stem cells, the arsenic-transformed stem cells, form these highly aggressive and highly pleomorphic types of tumors. They contained epithelial and mesenchymal components, which suggested a more pluripotent type of cell, a cancer stem cell, that's driving this tumorigenesis. So next, looking at possibly increasing the number of stem cells during transformation. Now, these data are looking at just the normal stem cells versus the arsenic-treated stem cells. You see on the left, we show an increase not only in the number of 3D spheres that you see here, but also there was increases in the size of stem cells. And those who may not know, these 3D spheres are typically initiated from and highly enriched in stem or cancer stem-like cells. When we looked at the 3D spheres versus the its control untreated spheres, but then also the adherent cells, only the sphere cells showed an increase in MMP activity and pretty much the same in all the other in vitro metrics of transformation that we saw. So that was interesting that we didn't really see any change in MMPs in the arsenic-treated adherent cells. So we did another xenograft assay with these and separating out the sphere cells from the adherent cells and injected those sub-Q. And what we got were only the cells, only the mice injected with the sphere cells, the arsenic-treated sphere cells developed tumors. And the tumors were very similar to the ones that I showed on the previous slide, highly pleomorphic, highly aggressive. So this showed that the cancer stem cells were found in these 3D spheres and not in the adherent cells that were also treated with arsenic. So during the transformation process, we also looked at more mechanistic sorts of effects. And again, consistently across the cell lines, we saw this unusual U-shaped trend in the expression of several stem cell-associated signaling factors or differentiation factors. P63 is shown here, but you see all the other ones at the bottom of the slide that we looked at. And we weren't really sure what was causing this trend, what the reversal of this trend, what could be causing that. And when we started looking at different other cancer-associated factors like tumor suppressors, we saw P10 had this, starting around 9 to 12 weeks, we saw a depletion of P10. And if you compare this, the start of this drop to where this the trend in the stem cell signaling factors reverses on the left, it seems to be right around the same time. So this suggested that P10 may be playing a role in this unusual U-shaped trend, maybe at least one factor involved in the reversal of that. Okay, so with those in vitro studies, we showed that arsenic does, there is a survival selection to arsenic. It does increase the number of stem cells, and it can lead to a cancer stem cell overabundance. So we wanted to dig a little bit deeper, and we got interested in the microenvironment. So we wanted to show, wanted to test how arsenic might affect this microenvironment and if there were some effects with that that might lead to this cancer stem cell overabundance that we see in vivo in the animal tumors as well as in our in vitro models. I didn't realize there was animation on this slide, but. So we turned to this, we developed this co-culture model, and this was done by past postdoc Yuanyuan Zhu. And this is just simply these tissue culture plate inserts where we, inside the insert, we plated the transformed parental line, the KSPE cell line, so the malignant epithelial cells. And then in the bottom of the well, we plated the normal, never exposed stem cells. In the shaded area in this diagram, that is, you see here, that's all shared conditioned medium. This is a microporous membrane here, so anything secreted by one cell can come into contact or affect the other cell line. So what Laura saw after only just a few weeks, you see in the bottom left, there was a pretty rapid acquisition of cancer phenotype. And many of the changes that we saw in those stem cells that were co-cultured with the arsenic transformed cells, many of these characteristics matched the changes or the character effects that we saw in the stem cells that were directly transformed by arsenic. We see on the left, this is P10 depletion. In the middle, this is MMP9 increases, activity increase. We even see this unusual, which was turning out to be maybe not so unusual now, U-shaped trend in various stem cell signaling factors, see here. And when we sort of did a panel of tests to see what secreted factors might be at least playing a role in this acquisition of cancer phenotype. And interleukin 6 was one that looked like a very good candidate. So when we compared this secreted interleukin 6 levels from the KSPE cells, which are the ones in this top insert here, compared to the parental cell line, the control cell line, saw about three or four-fold higher levels of secreted interleukin 6 in the arsenic transform line. So we wanted to see if what would happen if we just added interleukin 6 directly to the stem cells. And sure enough, again, after I think just 1 or 2 weeks, we saw this is showing MMP9 activity increase in the interleukin 6 treated stem cells compared to the control stem cells. So interleukin 6, as I said, does appear to be at least one of the secreted factors that's involved in this acquisition of cancer phenotype in this co-culture method. So after that study, I got interested in looking at extracellular vesicles that could be secreted from the arsenic transformed cells, particularly exosomes. And you see in the diagrams here, these are just very small vesicles that where there's biological cargo packaged inside the original cell, and then it's secreted and it's either taken up by the recipient cell, or there's the receptor ligand sort of interaction on the recipient cell. And the reason I was thinking of exosomes is because those have been shown in several studies to mediate several processes such as carcinogenesis, cell-cell communication, immune system function, and so on. So when we looked at this, this is a study, very nice study done by Intube or Olive and Gallame, and finished up by Tony Luz, two past postdocs in my group. So just to look if there were extracellular vesicles involved in this, so what we call stem cell recruitment in the co-culture model, we exposed the cells to conditioned medium that contained the extracellular vesicles, as well as conditioned medium where the extracellular vesicles were depleted by ultracentrifugation. And in all the factors we looked at, we only saw increased sort of in vitro transformation metrics were only increased in the cells exposed to the conditioned media that contain the extracellular vesicles you see here in the middle. We also looked at epithelial mesenchymal transition, morphologically at least. And again, the conditioned medium with the extracellular vesicles, those cells were the only ones where we saw this transition to a more mesenchymal-like morphology, the long spindle-like cells. So to dig a little deeper into those extracellular vesicles and to show that it was indeed exosomes, we isolated and quantified all the exosomes released by the KSPE cells, the arsenic transformed cells versus the parental RWPE1, the control cells. And you see here the data on the left that the arsenic transformed cells secrete about sevenfold higher level of exosomes compared to the RWPE1 parental controls. And when we looked at a few other, so total particle number, as I said, was about sevenfold higher. You see in the table here. And total protein was about sixfold higher, and total RNA was about 420%, fourfold higher in the arsenic transformed cells versus the control cells. And this was all normalized to 50 million cells per cell line. So this showed that arsenic definitely increases the amount, the number of exosomes that are secreted from the cells compared to the control cells. So looking at the biological cargo in those KSPE exosomes versus the control cells, starting at with the graphs here on the right, these are KSPE exosomes in the gray, RWP1 exosomes in the black bars. Text is a little small, maybe hard to see, but You can see these are all inflammation-associated factors, all significantly upregulated in the exosomes from the arsenic-transformed cells. Similar with the oncogenes we looked at, much higher levels in the arsenic-transformed cells. And then this is just on the right, the Western blot, that's this KRAS protein. Again, much higher in the arsenic-transformed cells, but also in the arsenic, the exosomes from the arsenic-transformed cells. The very busy table you see on the left, this is looking at cancer-associated microRNAs. We looked at, this is a PCR microarray that we looked at these and confirmed a lot of these results with qPCR. But this looks at 80, this array had 80 cancer-associated microRNAs. And when comparing the parental RWPE1 to the arsenic-transformed KSPE cells, 61 out of the 80 microRNAs were dysregulated in the KSPE cells. But what was more interesting to us, or to me at least, looking at the microRNAs just in the KSPE cells, and that's what this table shows, comparing the exosomal microRNAs to the cellular microRNAs in the KSPE cells, you can see, and it might be hard to see, there was animation on this slide that I removed, but 18 of these microRNAs, and these are the ones in the see in the green boxes, 18 of these were similarly changed as far as in the exosomes versus the intracellular microRNAs. And similarly changed, I mean, they were in the same direction and to a similar magnitude of change. But 43 of these, and those are the ones in the red boxes, 43 of these microRNAs were changed only in the exosomes. So this to us suggested that arsenic either alters or affects the packaging of the microRNAs into these exosomes before release from the cell, or it somehow affects the biogenesis of these microRNAs inside the exosomes. And unfortunately, we weren't able to really dig into that question or not, but maybe hopefully sometime in the future we can get back to that and try to answer that question. But I think I've gone over my time limit, so I'll just end really quick with the conclusion slide. Hopefully I've shown and maybe convinced you today that arsenic is a transplacental and a whole life carcinogen. In our rodent models, we showed that. During transformation, arsenic exposure results in a cancer stem cell overabundance. We've seen that in both the animal tumors, the tumors from the animals, as well as our in vitro models. This overabundance seems to be through some altering of several key stem cell signaling, stem cell associated signaling pathways. That unusual U-shaped trend may be the result of this P10 depletion. And arsenic also has pretty significant impacts on the microenvironment. We saw in the co-culture model that arsenic transformed cells can seem to what we call recruit these normal stem cells into a cancer stem cell phenotype. And finally, the studies on the exosomes show that arsenic can greatly alter not just the quantity of exosomes released, but also what we'll call cancer-favoring cargo in those exosomes. And can't do all of this work without the help of a lot of people. You see some past and present members in my what's now the Stem Cells Toxicology Group. And then, of course, Mike Walkies, who's, like I said, he's been retired for several years now, but he really deserves the credit for those transplacental studies. Alex Merrick, who's been a huge help in a lot of these studies. And I always forget people on this acknowledgement slide. So if you don't see your name and you know you helped out, I thank you, and I apologize for missing your name. But if there is any time left, I'll try to answer any questions that people might have.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Silva, for a great presentation. We do have a couple of minutes for some questions. So just one final reminder, you can ask a question in the Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. So the first question that came in, let's see, the experiments do not note the arsenic concentrations used, except for the eighth slide, the TP carcinogen identifies the concentrations at 42.5 and 85 parts per million. These are levels that are several thousand-fold higher than the U.S. drinking water standard of 10 parts per billion. Were any of the studies conducted using lower levels, and what are the results at this much lower level?
I believe all of the transmucental studies were done at those 42.5 and 85 ppm. Yes, we acknowledge those are very high levels, but one thing that I think is important to bring up with a question like this is that pretty well known, I would say, at least in the arsenic research field, that there's some pretty significant differences between the metabolism and the toxicokinetics between humans and mice. And to get similar internal doses in a mouse that you can get in a human, you know, most times you have to give the mouse a much, much higher external dose. And again, we fully admit those were high levels in the transmucental, but it is a factor. When we did look at internal levels in some of those mouse studies, looked at arsenic levels in the serum, they were very similar, slightly higher, but very similar to arsenic serum levels in cases of arsenicosis, of arsenic poisoning. So there is, you know, some human relevance to those internal levels. And also, yes, to answer the other part of that question, we did, as I mentioned on the whole life model, in vivo models slide, that we did greatly reduce those arsenic concentrations to one of the studies was down, is still in the parts per million. It was 6, 12, and 24. But the last one we did, which I think was published in 2013, maybe 2014, a few years ago, that one we dropped it down to 50 parts per billion, so 50 parts per billion with a B, and we still got lung tumors, mostly in the male mice. So we do realize those in the transmucental were very high, but when we did drop them down, we still got tumors in the mice. Not all the ones we got in the transmucental studies at the higher levels, but it was still, the levels were still carcinogenic in the mice.
Okay, we have time for one more question. So this is going to take a little bit to read. So very nice study. Since your studies and Dr. Walkie's have supported both the Barker hypothesis and the stem cell hypothesis, as well as the epigenetic hypothesis, rather than arsenic mutagenesis mechanism, have you measured OCT4A in your normal and cancer stem cells? Also, have you considered that by stimulating stem cell proliferation in utero or after birth, that error of DNA replication, not error of DNA repair, might have increased the mutations?
Yeah, we haven't really looked into that much. We have looked at OCT4, OCT4A, and I didn't really mention it, but when at least in the in vitro models, when we the slide where I showed that U-shaped trend with the stem cell associated stem cell signaling factors, OCT4 was one that we looked at. I can't remember if we looked at OCT4 in all of the in vitro models, but in the one I was talking about today, we looked at it, and we see that similar U-shaped trend. So we have looked at it in that OCT4 in that sense. As far as the DNA repair part of the question, I mean, that's what you're saying is possible. We haven't really looked into that, so I I don't really have any data I can discuss address that question.
Okay, well, thank you again, Dr. Tokar. We're going to have to move along because we're near the end, but we will send all of the questions again to all the presenters. So before we conclude, I wanted to make sure that everybody is aware of the Related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. So this will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place these seminars in an archive with a soundtrack, so in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentations. Also, in the Related URLs pod, you will find the seminar feedback form, and we ask that you consider filling out that online feedback form. We look at your comments, and as we try to continue to improve the content and delivery mechanisms, and feedback is very helpful with those, with that. So you can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. I would also like to remind the participants of the various ways to stay connected to make sure you don't miss any future webinars. So for more information on EPA CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN.org website. You can also subscribe to the free monthly newsletter, TechDirect, and follow CLUIN on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And we encourage you to visit the SRP Risky Learning webpage for information about upcoming sessions and archives. And you can also follow SRP on Twitter. So I would like to encourage you, everyone, to join us on June 16th for the final session in the series. This fourth session, presenters will discuss emerging toxicology and modeling methods, as well as the needs to better link exposure to latent disease risk. So if you'd like to join the webinar, we encourage you to register now. And if you cannot attend, again, we always make the archives available after the event. And you can come back to these pages for the links to the archives after the webinar. And finally, if you weren't able to attend the first two sessions, we encourage you to check out the archives that are available on the CLUIN website. So with that, it's time to conclude today's webinar. If you submitted an online question and we didn't have time to get to it, we will pass those questions along to our presenters. And if you have additional questions, you can also contact the presenters via email. Their email addresses are on the seminar homepage on CLUIN. I would like to thank our presenters, Yu Chen, Maria Argos, Fena Sillier, and Eric Tokar for their time preparing and for sharing their great presentations with us today. I would also like to thank Sarah Amolegbe, who helped put everything together for today's webinar and the support during the webinar, along with Jean Ballant, who manages the CLUIN platform and ensures that everything's running smoothly. So thank you to you both and to our presenters. And that concludes today's presentation. Thank you for your participation and for your time today.